Hello, welcome to the Snooker Scene Podcast. I'm Dave Hendon. This week, my guest is Neil Robertson, the 2010 world champion. Of course, the most successful non-British player the game's ever seen. Now, the first thing to say about this is that we arranged to do the interview at the Champion of Champions in Coventry after Neil's first match. It turned out to be his only match because he was beaten by Stuart Bingham. And I have to say, a lot of players would have driven home through disappointment and said, can we do it another time? Neil stayed behind. Not only did he stayed behind for 70 minutes, the longest podcast by far. And what you'll hear over the course of the interview is a lot of really interesting stuff, I think. I think it's a real insight into really the mindset of a top snooker player. One of the things that impressed me about Neil was just how much he remembered of the matches he'd played. He seemed to remember every shot he played. And you'll hear a little bit of an obsessional character, actually, but a thoroughly nice guy as well, very articulate, and I really, really enjoyed talking to him. So this is the Snooker Scene Podcast with Neil Robertson. Neil, I always start by asking players how they got into snooker, and it's usually a familiar story in the UK. It's usually their parents bought them a half-size table for Christmas. Growing up in Australia, what was your introduction?
I used to play snooker, actually nine ball and eight ball with my dad and my brother on weekends. We did. I used to just play once a week. I don't know, my brother and I would play for about half an hour or something, and then we'd go play the arcade machines and stuff like that. We would have been about 10 or 11 years old.
So it was already in the family? Snooker was in the family?
No, not really. My dad didn't really play that much snooker. He just liked playing sort of pool and nine ball. I mean, he wasn't very good back then. He was just played it casually. It was just something to do with his sons. My parents were divorced when I was about 3 or 4 years old, so it was just something that my dad and my brother and Mark, my brother Mark and I could do. That was it was a lot of fun that the three of us could do together. So after sort of going to the same club for about 6 months, my dad became interested in buying half of the business as the one of the owners was selling up, so my dad bought his share, and then that's when we started to get into Q Sports more seriously. I used to play every Sunday morning. My dad used to run like a junior competition. I think obviously it gave Mark and I something to do. Just used to play every Sunday mornings, from probably age 11 to sort of 13. It wasn't really sort of playing 4 or 5 days a week. It was just like, just a casual, nice thing to do. But it didn't take me very long to become, a lot better than the other juniors and stuff like that. And then from the age of around 13, I used to practice a bit after school and school holidays. I did a lot of practice as well.
And was that seen as sort of unusual? Because a lot of the Australian sports that we think of are all outdoors, because we associate your climate as being a lot better than ours. So were your mates sort of thinking, why is he playing snooker all the time?
No, not really. I mean, I used to play because I used to play like a little bit of snooker, a little bit of 8-ball, a little bit of 9-ball. A lot of people in Australia play 9-ball and 8-ball casually. The participation in those particular sports is very high. So it's not that unusual at all, really. I still love playing outside, like kicking the footy around and all that sort of stuff. But from when I was about sort of 14 or 15, then it was just purely all sort of snooker and 8-ball and stuff like that. So,
And your junior career, it sounds like you developed pretty quickly and became one of the best juniors, if not the best junior in the country, pretty quickly.
Yeah, it didn't take long. I think, especially when I was about sort of 14, I started to really, really dominate everything, even the under-18s and stuff like that, and compete really well in the under-21s. That was when I started playing, probably about sort of like 2 or 3 days a week. And then it was just a natural progression through there. And then when I left school, when I was 15, that was obviously when I started to take a lot more of a full-time approach to playing snooker.
You turned pro when you were 16. How did that come about?
I still ask myself that. it's one thing that really annoys me when I see on the captions when it says when I turned pro 98, so people think I've been consistently on the tour for so long, where I mean I was 16 and I was just absolutely nowhere near good enough. The Oceania Championships was held at my own snooker club,
right.
Not my
That's
dad's
handy.
One yeah. I knew all the tables perfectly. They were really big pockets, so it suited me at the time. And they took 4 players, so you had to make the semi-finals to get a professional tour card. And And I hadn't been past the last 16 of any tournament in Australia. Right. And then I get to the semis of that one and all of a sudden I'm going to England. So, I just wasn't prepared at all. I wasn't good enough and I just wasn't ready. You know, I had no plans whatsoever of coming to England at 16. Mm. It was just, I happened to sort of qualify and then, you know, my dad thought it would be a great experience for me to go over.
What did you know of the professional circuit? Did you even see the tournaments in Australia? Did you see any of it?
No, we never used to get any of the events. I think around then they started to show it a little bit on the pay TV, on Foxtel, but we just used to have to wait for the videotapes to be sent over from England, so we'd already know the results, and just, you know, wait for somebody who would have recorded all the stuff on the BBC and then just send it to Australia.
Yeah. Was there any question of you not coming? Because 16 is young to suddenly come off around the world.
No, my dad was really super keen for me to come over, and I guess I was as well, just to see what it would be like. I had, you know, Steve Misford, Joel Younger and Sean Budd were also over there with me. So, they looked after me really well when I came over. But, I don't really have too many positives from the experience because I just wasn't anywhere near good enough. The tables were so much harder than what I was used to. I was used to playing on sort of big pockets on club tables. And they were professional tables, tight pockets and the super fine cloths. It was a bit of a nightmare, but... I had a couple of sort of decent results. I mean, I beat Joel Younger, which was really funny. Yeah. We got drawn against each other. Yeah. Overall, it was a worthwhile experience just to sort of get a feel and see how everything was.
I think you told me once that you actually got relegated on, it was your 18th birthday. You got played in the World Championship and lost to someone, and that was you off the tour.
I missed out the follow. Obviously, I fell off the tour my first year, and then I won the Oceania Championships when I was 18. I was much more full-time player then. When I was 16, I was still kind of like a kid who's just left school, who doesn't really want to do anything. So I didn't really dedicate to snooker 100% or anything. I mean, I was just sort of lazing around. When I was 18, I was playing a lot more full-time and I was much more prepared for the tour. I had some promising results, actually. I did pretty well. I think I won 10 matches. I lost 10-8 to Ian McCulloch in the World Championships in the fourth round. And I probably would have had a chance to get to the last round to play Tony Drago. So that was a much better experience for me. I didn't do enough to stay on the tour, but I got a wild card. They had 10 wild cards that year.
Yeah.
And I got one of the wild cards. And then that following season... they changed the way the structure of the seasons were, the events were, where they weren't block qualifiers. You know, I used to be able to come over from Australia, play the four qualifying events, and then just fly back home. These were a bit more sort of spaces in between. There was only one at Burton on Trent, and then there's another qualifier like a month later. So I couldn't really fly back and forth. So I had to move to somewhere in the UK and. Alan Perkins, Mark Selby's coach at the time, said that I could stay with him and practice at Willie Thorne's. And I made the big move to move over. That was, wasn't the best experience because it wasn't what I thought it was going to be. You go to Willie Thorne's, I'm thinking like, oh, I'll get to play with all, professionals and really good playing conditions and all that, but it wasn't anything like what I thought it would be. There was one match table there, which was Willie Thorne's table, which Mark Selby kind of had the priority and rightly so, which left me to play on like the club tables and stuff, which was, when you're practicing on club tables and then you go into the professional tables with the fine cloths and the much tighter pockets, this made it pretty tough for me to adjust, and my technique wasn't quite as good as what it is now to make those kind of adjustments. So I actually really struggled, and then it didn't take long really before I really started to experience what homesickness was, and then I kind of, the last few months, was a little bit of a write-off really. I just wanted to go home. I didn't really want to be there. It wasn't, Leicester, no disrespect to Leicester, but it's definitely not Cambridge. I just really didn't enjoy my time there at all. With the results I had earlier in the season, I had to win, I think, one or two matches in the World Championship to keep my tour place, and I lost to James Reynolds 10-9 on my birthday. That would have been my My 20th birthday, that would have been.
Right.
Yeah, so that sort of topped the whole trip off, really.
And was there a sense, you, obviously, as you say, homesick, it's a difficult game, maybe a more difficult game than you thought when you were young.
Mm.
Was there a sense that this just isn't for me, maybe I should do something else?
Yeah, it was very tough for overseas players back then. There was no bases to go, there was no academies, there was very few other overseas players on the tour, so... Yeah, I didn't really know anyone, even though sort of, you know, getting to know Mark Selby quite well. But the problem was I was, you know, I don't know. I wouldn't say I was depressed, but I wouldn't have been far off. You know, I was sleeping all day, so I was getting to the club really late, and Mark was there from sort of like, you know, 9:30 in the morning till, you know, sort of 3 or 4, and I was sort of coming into the club at around sort of 3 or 4. So it was just complete sort of chaos, really, and. I went back. That's when I sort of started to really sort of think about things. I thought, well, you know, do I really want this kind of lifestyle? Because I didn't really, you know, the game was up in the air as well. Like, I mean, there was a lot of negativity around the sponsorship of the sport, with, you know, being heavily reliant on the tobacco sponsorship, and all that was evaporating. Even for a young person, how I was back then, you could see that the game wasn't run properly. So how much longer is the game going to continue on for, you know? So, there's a lot of thinking to do with myself and, you know, what I wanted to do. So I went back home and I had a little bit of a break and, you know, obviously really down, never been more down in my life before. Sort of just completely stopped practicing, didn't really want to play, didn't really want to do anything, so I just kind of... just went through each day, not really doing much, just chilling out, playing video games, and, you know, not really bothering looking for work. You know, because the thing is that when you're so young and when you've got aspirations of being a professional snooker player, professional sportsman, you know, you kind of think you're too good to work. And then I sort of saw if I had to get a job as complete failure. And all the kids from school knew that I was really good at snooker and had gone over to England. And then, you know, if they're sort of like... pulled into McDonald's or something and seen me there flipping burgers. I thought, oh, like, you know, could just never allow myself to be, you know, like that. So, I went to the job centre because, I mean, I had no income whatsoever. I was living with my brother in a tiny apartment. He was working full time, a couple of jobs, so he was really helping me out as well financially. I was in the job centre and I was in the queue and there was just people, like, there was a guy at the head of the queue, at the counter, sort of, he got denied his dole check or something, and he started really kicking off and swearing at, you know, all the people that were working there, and I just sort of, like, was just looking around me, just seeing these type of people who were, you know, applying for the dole, and I just thought, like, I just can't, like, allow, I just, you know, I'm just so much better than this, I've got to go home and think of something, whether it be snooker, whether it be something else, whether it be go do it like a course, like a TAFE course, get an apprenticeship, something like that. So I kind of went back, had to think of things, and the Australian Under 21 Snooker Championship was coming up, and so I thought I'd play in that. You know, I still love snooker, but I didn't really practice. I just I practiced for maybe a week before I went up, and I played pretty well. I made the record highest break in the Under 21 Championship. I think it was like 142. I won that, which gave me a spot to go play in the World Under 21s in New Zealand. And the funny thing was, though, is that winning the Under 21s gave me full expenses paid to New Zealand. Now, originally I wasn't going to play in the Under 21s, even though I knew I would have got a spot to play in the World Under 21s in New Zealand anyway, because they were taking 8 Australian players. But Mike Peachey really convinced me to enter it, because he knew that I was really down and that I didn't want to play, but he convinced me to enter it because of I'd get the expenses paid, because come to the time of the World Under 21s, maybe I wouldn't have gone. I probably wouldn't have been able to get the money to fly over to New Zealand and play in it. So winning that gave me the expenses paid for. But I was still really down, and then, you know, I was just thinking, well, even if I win it, you know, it's not really going to do anything anyway, because back then there weren't any tour cards for... the World Under 21s or anything like that. And then I got an email off Keith Warren. Who said that he'd been talking to Steve Misford, and Steve Misford was telling Keith how well I was sort of playing, like, from the back end of the Australian season. I beat Steve in the final in the Australian Open. I think I beat him 8-0 or 8-1, and like played really, really well. So Keith obviously knew me from my time previously on the tour. He had sort of like helped out a lot of the younger players, a couple of the overseas players as well. And he sent me an email saying that that there's every chance that there's going to be a wild card opportunity for you if you perform well in New Zealand, because there was 5 overseas wild cards given, which I didn't know about until then, and that was probably about a week before the World Under 21s. And so I was like, oh wow, like, oh, this could be my chance. And so then I practiced really hard for the World Under 21s. I performed really well through the group stages and got through my first. Keith had told me after I qualified through the group stages that, like I was 99% sure going to get the tour card, so I was like obviously over the moon with that. And then the first match I was playing Habib Subar from Bahrain, and it was 1-5, and I was 3-0 down. But I didn't do a great deal wrong. But then Keith sort of like walked in. I was thinking, oh my God, this guy's just giving me a wild card. I feel quite terrible. And I had 390s and a century to win 5-3. And then I beat Alex Davies in the last 16, 5-4. I beat Pankaj Advani in the quarters. That would have been maybe 5-1 or 5-2. And then I beat Ding Junhui in a really good semi-final. I think that was what was the score there? It would have been about 8-5 or 8-6 then. And then I beat Louis Song in the final, 11-5. Played really. I had 3 centuries to be 5-1 up. So that was kind of like the first time I'd really kind of performed like good enough to my sort of ability. I played really well, and that World Under 21s, like, you'll never see a better field than that ever.
Yeah.
Yeah, you had like Mark Allen in it as well, and many other sort of top players that were sort of top 32 and regular tour players now. So to win that event, gave me a huge amount of confidence, and it secured my tour card, and then it was off and ready to go.
Yeah, and this brings us neatly to, because we often hear about you. He came to the UK with £500 in his pocket and all this. I mean, is that actually the case? And where did you get the £500 from?
Yeah, my mum.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. And why Cambridge? Why did you end up there?
Phil Mumford was playing on their snooker tournaments in Australia, and he, the management position at the Cambridge Snooker Centre came available, and he emailed Steve Misford saying that there was a house up for rent right next to the club in the car park, so Steve got a hold of Joel Younger and myself and said, did you guys all want to share a house together? And I thought, like, perfect. I can actually live with Australians. Didn't know anything about Cambridge. My experiences of England was Blackpool, Leicester and Burton-on-Trent. So I was just like, well, the whole place is just a wreck compared to Australia. So,
no offence to anyone who lives in any of those places.
So we moved over, and my mum just like gave me was about like maybe $800, like $1,000 or something, so that was like the money I had to sort of get me by the first 4 or 5 weeks or whatever. And my mother's my mum's partner Chris Corr, he really helped me out a lot as well, because he said that, like, whatever happens, if you ever get stuck, you can use his bank card in emergencies.
Right.
So if there was any sort of situation where, like, I can just completely run out of money, that I wouldn't have to just go home or borrow money in other ways, at least I could sort of pay my travel expenses and stuff. So, I mean, it wasn't a magic wand that everything was for free at all. And I didn't really use it that often, because... I did at the start to help sort of pay for the entries, and World Snooker were really good with the overseas players as well by giving us helping us with funds to contribute towards our flight, so that made paying the airfare to come over much easier. And we ended up in Cambridge, and straight away, just a completely different place to anywhere else in the UK I'd been before. The weather was really nice because it was in the summer as well. A great feel about the whole city, and living with Steve and Joel really helped a lot. You know, great friends of mine I'd known ever since I was like sort of, you know, 12, 13 years old. And the club was great as well, because Joe Perry had just become the resident professional there. Joe had left his old club, I think in Whiz Beach or something like that. And Joe was just absolutely amazing with the three of us. Joe let us play on his table when he had finished playing. That was amazing for me. I wasn't allowed to do that at Willie Thorne's. So, you know, Joe played a massive role in helping me improve and get used to the tables, because, you know, it was really, really difficult, because I was used to so much bigger pockets and such slower tables. So at least I could practice on Joe's and get ready for the tournaments by at least knowing how they're going to play and getting used to the tight pockets. So, he was invaluable.
I was going to bring Joe up, because it's one of the most incredible things I've seen in the game, is after you beat him in that final in China, and of course at that stage you hadn't won a ranking tournament, and you beat him, and you were, you were the one in tears, because you think, oh, I've denied my friend, you know, his big chance.
Yeah, that's right, because I knew how much it meant to Joe, and, I thought, you know, maybe he may not win one again, or, you know, you just never know. Yeah. So, I was really emotional afterwards, and I was quite surprised, actually, how I was able to sort of ruthlessly sort of dispatched the match from 9-8 down to win 10-9, I think it was. It was just, you know, it was really tough, and but I was so happy for him when he won the player championship later on in the season. You know, seeing how relieved he was as well when he won it, because, you know, Joe is like, you know, you see it, many other players have won tournaments, and Joe's like, you know, just as entitled to win tournaments as they were. So to see him, yeah, win that tournament, I was so pleased for him. And then I didn't have to feel so bad about myself as well.
Yeah. Okay, so you're back on the tour. So this is like sort of early 2000s, I guess. And you sort of got a reputation for being a really sort of good potter. But that at that stage, I guess, was the main part of your game. You hadn't developed then into the player you are now in terms of the all-round game. But I guess you were learning all the time.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I mean, that was pretty much... Because I used to practice long potting all the time, and I didn't really have anyone to teach me the sort of professional way of building breaks. I had some really good coaches in Australia who were good practice partners that were, you know, good for the conditions back home, but playing on a professional table is completely different altogether. So I guess in a way, because I'm really observant and I always pick up what people are doing, practicing with Joe was incredible. Although he wasn't like a hands-on coach of telling me technical things or anything like that, by just basically pulling balls out for him, you know, losing 15-3, 15-4 to him every day. I learned a great deal, and once again, he's sort of, you know, he was extremely generous with his time, it goes without any doubt that I wouldn't have progressed as quickly without him.
I think everyone thought, you know, you were a potential tournament winner, but until you actually do it, you know, you've actually got to do it, haven't you? You've got to prove it, and you did at the 10 years ago now at the Grand Prix in Aberdeen. What are your memories of that? I think it was a round robin early on in that tournament.
Yeah, it was, yeah. Well, I think the World Championships the previous season, I got to the quarterfinals and I was 13-12 to Graham Dott, and I'd already made a couple of quarterfinals, so I was kind of like, you know, starting to knock on the door. And I really felt I could have won the World Championship that year, and I would have been 22 or 23. Probably would have been 23, I think. And I was young enough and dumb enough to think that I could win it. So I think I really could have done. But I was very confident with my game. It was my first year getting into the top 16. And then the Grand Prix. It was a round robin format. Obviously, World Snooker were looking to, you know, change the formats of a few of the events. And it was a round robin format. I lost the first match, I think, to Nigel Bond 3-2. So I had a lot of work to do to get out of the group, and I won the remainder of my games. I think I even played Judd Trump in that. You know, I'm just trying to think. Did I? Yeah, I think I played Judd Trump in that. Yeah, incredible. You know, just to think he was like 16 or 17 or something. I had Joe Swale in my group and Ken Doherty, who I had to beat to progress, and I beat Ken 3-1. And so I got through the group feeling really good and played Andrew Norman. I beat him 5-3. He played very well. I did a really good clearance to win the last frame on the black. And then I was due to play Ronnie O'Sullivan in the quarters, who back then was sort of seen as nearly unbeatable if his head was on the job, you know. So that was like a real opportunity for me to try and sort of you know, claim my place among, you know, the best players in the world. And yeah, I played a great match from memory. The last two frames from 3-1. I think he's broken off. I've knocked in a long red. I've won the frame off it, and then the next frame off, he's left me a long red off a safety, and I've knocked in and then won the frame off it again. And yeah, he was really he was really nice to me after the match. You know, he had a lot of really kind words to me to say, and yeah, which also was really nice from him, because you know, you don't usually sort of see that from him unless he kind of really means it. So yeah, so that put me into the semi-finals, and I was full of confidence, and I didn't think, you know, I thought I just had to sort of keep that up, and I'll have a great chance of winning.
Mm. So, and you did win it, but here we are 10 years later, and there's quite a few players who've won tournaments, and they might not win another one, but you've won at least one title of some sort every year since. Mm. Some years, quite a few titles. I mean, that's quite a proud record to have. You obviously got a taste of winning.
Yeah, I think I was watching the replay on Eurosport when I won the Riga Masters earlier this season, and I think you mentioned it, and I was like, oh, wow. Because I always thought, I thought, I've won a tournament every year, but I never sort of really thought about how many years it is consecutively by winning a tournament, and, you know, to be the only player to do that, yeah, it's quite an incredible record. Mm. I'm obviously very proud of that. You know, maybe it might come to an end one day, but I really hope not. Yeah, very, very, very proud of that record, and you know, goes to show, I guess, how consistent I've been.
But also, your game has improved, hasn't it, over the years as well? Because your break building, in particular, we'll talk in a minute about the 100 centuries, but also, I guess, you had to learn the tactical game as well as you went along.
Yeah, I was very unpredictable. Even that season when I won the Grand Prix and then won the Welsh Open in the 2006-07 season, I was very much all out attack. It wasn't always reckless, but it was not seeing a really good opportunity to play a really good safety shot when maybe that was a better alternative than playing for a long red. So, because sometimes you can actually be more aggressive by turning down a long red and actually playing a really good safety shot. Not many people sort of realise that. That was something that I had to learn, because I was getting tied up by Stephen Maguire all the time. I actually found him harder to beat than Ronnie O'Sullivan and John Higgins, because John Higgins, Ronnie O'Sullivan, they play quite aggressive, and it's a sort of like a different way of playing. But Stephen, his safety was just so good, and he'd score so heavy. His long potting was very good. I just couldn't get anywhere near him, and he was the player I kind of looked at, thinking, like, you know, this, unless I really improve my game, like, I'm just going to become your second best to this guy all the time. Because, you know, Stephen was, you know, he won the UK. He was seen as the next big thing. To dominate the sport, and so he was sort of like the benchmark for me in me trying to improve my game to compete with him with the safety.
But you were improving as a player, but you were also gained a little bit of a reputation for being, how can we say, a little bit scatterbrained around the tournaments, in terms of preparation. I mean, the one year at the Premier League, you got on the wrong train and all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, that wasn't deliberate,
but
your sort of charge sheet started to grow a little bit with things like that. You couldn't find your passport before one tournament, all this sort of stuff.
The German Masters was coming up, and I hadn't flown anywhere for a long time. Obviously, we didn't have as many tournaments back then. That was the year I was world champion, and Ronnie had just pulled out, and Nigel Oldfield got on the phone and called me, before he called me, in fact, I actually told World Snooker I've lost my passport. Mm. And I was playing in 2 days' time. I thought, there's no way you can get a passport in that time. And Nigel Oldfield called me back that day saying, Neil, mate, just to let you know, Ronnie's pulled out of the German Masters. We cannot have Ronnie O'Sullivan pull out and the world champion. You have to get there. Mm. I was like, okay, mate, I'll try my best. And so I spoke to Mum and Chris, and they sort of did some research on the best way of quickest way of getting a passport. And so I took the next... I went down first thing in the morning, got a train to London, filled out all the paperwork, everything I needed to get a new passport to, you know, prove that I was playing in the tournament and all this sort of stuff. They were getting it all processed, and then the next morning I had to go back down to London with my snooker cue and my bags. I had to go straight from the place where I picked up the passport straight to Heathrow, fly to German Masters the day I was playing, got beat by Anthony Hamilton 5-4 and flew back home. So I was like, I did my bit for World Snooker, but I really wish that I didn't go.
He played. He had three centuries. He played really well, actually.
Yeah, he did. He played really well. Yeah, yeah. No, he did. I didn't play terrible by any means, but I was absolutely wrecked. So,
but there was also, you're at the Crucible, I think I'm right in saying, you'd forgotten your shoes. You had to go and buy a pair of shoes.
I had absolutely everything, and then I left my shoes, and I was getting ready to play Steve Maguire in the last 16, and I put my shirt on, my trousers, waistcoat, put on my bow tie, and then I put on my socks, and I'm like, yep, okay, I'll just get my shoes. Oh, where are they? And so this is like, I don't know, an hour before I'm playing my match, and so we've gone down to the Crucible, and then just gone to the shops across the road, and I've picked out a pair of shoes, and they weren't uncomfortable, but they looked horrendous, and that was really in my mind in the match, and Stephen played really well, and he was like, but you know, he won the first, second, and third frame. I'd made a couple of mistakes, and I was just thinking, oh God, these shoes must just look awful on TV, and I went 9-0 down in the match, and I actually fought back pretty well. I fought back to 11-7. So I won 7 out of the next 9, and then I think he knocked in a great long red, made 100, and that was pretty much it.
Well, let's stay at the Crucible. Let's talk about 2010, because obviously that was your, I guess, the highlight of your career. It had to be becoming world champion. But, of course, early on, second round, you're 11-5 down to Martin Gould, and you actually said you checked out the hotel. Did you think there was any hope there at 11-5?
Certainly not at 6-0. And that's the thing as well, you know, like people say, Martin Gould in the last 16, but the way Martin played in that match, if that was Ronnie O'Sullivan or Judd Trump, they'll be saying that is one of the best performers they have ever seen. He played ridiculous snooker. He was going for like the craziest of long pots. You know, he was like running out of position on the black and he's knocking in a long yellow when the white was like on the top cushion. I mean, it was just madness, and the balls were open. Like, nobody would do that, but he was just going for everything, and everything was just flying to the back of the pocket. And so I did really well to win the last two frames to make it 6-2. And then I thought, well, there's no way he can play like that in the next session. And so the nighttime session, he's doing the exact same thing. He's just, like, everything's just flying in. I can't really get my hand on the table to make an influence on the match. And I've done really well again to just hang in there and only lose 5-3. I think probably a lot of other players in the tournament would have been home already. So to be 11-5 down, you know, I think Sean Murphy had come back a couple of years before against Matthew Stevens from that deficit. But so I was due to check out. I was due to check out the next day, and obviously I didn't renew because I was staying in an apartment, so you've got to renew for a week. And I told the lady, no, not to renew. Like, is it okay if I just leave my bags and then pick them up, sort of like pretty much when I compete? But then something interesting happened. Steve Davis was playing John Higgins in the last 16, and I knew that the winner of our match was playing the winner of that match, and I knew that Martin would have an eye on that, especially being 11-5 up. He's probably thinking that, I'll see how John's playing, you know, and see if there's anything I can exploit. And but Steve Davis was winning the match, and I was thinking, like, I was praying for Steve to win, because not so much the fact that playing John Higgins is a much tougher proposition than Steve Davis at the time, but because that I knew that Martin would be watching that match, or he'll definitely be aware of it, and that if Steve Davis were to win, Martin would see that as probably the best opportunity he'll ever have of getting to the semifinals of the World Championship. And so I really fed off that. And I thought, you know what, this could give me a bit to work with here. So we went into the evening session. I was 11-5 down. Obviously, I've got to beat him 8-1. I mean, it's crazy when you think that you've actually got to win 8 of the 9 frames. And I could see that he was a little bit hesitant on the crazy balls he was going for. He wasn't going for so many the same way. He was playing sort of more full length screw pots, trying to sort of get good cue balls rather than going all out attack, which he was doing previously. And I really picked up on that. And then I went on to the aggressive. When I think I went 11-7, he was starting to make a couple of mistakes. And then I really went on the front foot and started to put him under a lot of pressure. I was playing immaculate safety. The crazy balls that he was going for, they weren't going in. And I got back into the match really well. And, I got back to, was I 12-10 down in the end? So I won 5 out of the first 6. And then I was really confident from 12-10. Because all I wanted to do basically was just get it to an interval. My goal was to get it to 12-8, and then I can really sort of apply some pressure. But, you know, to get in at, which was, what would it have been? It would have been 11-9.
Yeah,
11-9. And then obviously he went 12-10 up. But I played a really, really good match, you know. Obviously, he didn't maintain that perfect snooker because it's impossible to play three sessions in a row like that. So, yeah, I played really, really well. And Stephen Hendry said that in the decider, I knocked in a really good long red. It was do or die. And if I missed it, I would have gone out. And I knocked it in and I made a really good sort of crucial 50-odd break to put me in a commanding position on the last red. And then I you know, put him in trouble off the last red and cleared up to the brown or whatever it was to win.
So you get to the final, but also your mother has come over during the semi-final, and I don't think she'd ever
the
seen
final.
You. I think she came over during the semi-final.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I don't think she'd ever seen you play professionally before. So obviously...
No.
Obviously, very proud that she's there, but also were you thinking, oh, no, she's flown all this way. If I don't win now, it's going to be like a real letdown.
Yeah, because the quarterfinals, you know, I beat Steve 13-5 or something like that. And then Ali Carter probably had never played better as a professional in the semis, being what was I ahead of Ali? I was 6-2. I think I was like 10-6 up with like four centuries, and playing really, really well. Just like, you know, there wasn't a great deal he could do about it. My safety was unbelievable. I was scoring so heavy. My long potting was unbelievable. So I thought, yeah, you know, like. And then I had a little bit of a dodgy session against Ali, the final session, because I was 15-9 in front, and I was just thinking about, like, when Paul Hunter lost the match against Ken, I was thinking, just don't do the same. And so I had a little bit of a wobble where he won the first sort of few frames of that session, but I ended up winning sort of 17-13, I think it was. Yeah, so then I turned my phone on after I've won the semi-final. I'm full of confidence. And then she left a voicemail saying that they'd just left Singapore. You're 10-6 up at the moment. Keep it going. We've just left Singapore. We're going to get there to watch the final, my mum and Chris. And I was like, oh, wow. At first I was like, oh, wow, this is amazing. Yay, like, you know, my family can come and see me. It would have been great my dad to come over as well, but he's not as... I don't know. He didn't really sort of think about sort of booking flight and flying over during the semi-final. So... yeah, but what it did, it put me under a huge amount of pressure. Now that I've won, I'm so happy she came over.
Yeah.
But if I had lost, I could never be angry at her.
Yeah.
But it was a huge distraction because mentally I just wasn't prepared. And when she's come over, obviously that was the first time I'd seen her for about 10 months as well, you know. So that was very, very emotional seeing her. And it just, yeah, it was a complete distraction. I kind of lost my focus with that sort of destroyer mentality, which I had, where I'm going to win this final. Whoever I'm playing, I'm going to win it like 18-8 or something. Like, I'm just going to destroy whoever I'm playing. I was playing so well. And then, you know, and then the final against Dot, like, I've come out and, then gone to sit down, and she was there waving. And I almost started crying. And so I'm playing like the first frame almost with tears in my eyes. And I was 3-1 down, and I was just like, you know, I've got to shake out of this. And I sort of recovered pretty well to be 5-3 down in the first session. Second session, I played really well, actually. I got back to from 5-3. I think I was 8-5 up, and Graham sort of like came back a bit. I think it was a pretty crucial part of the match, because I think if I won one of the next two sort of frames and then maybe could have been 10-6 up, 10-5, then I think I would have really pushed on and won the match, like, you know, convincingly. He kept sort of clawing back. And then the overall standard was very good. The first two sessions, like, we both were above 90% pot success. It was very, very high-quality match play snooker. You know, the ball sort of went scrappy in a lot of the frames. And, you know, so they were longer drawn-out frames. But it was still very good. I think, like, you know, I think up to, like, the first sort of 14 frames that I had won in the final, I think I had 12 breaks over 50. So I was playing well. But then, you know, unfortunately, probably people just remember, like, you know, the last session, which was a really long, drawn-out affair. The times got changed as well, and we didn't do what you do now, is where you play that extra frame. Believe it or not, that makes a huge difference. Right. So I think I was like, what would I have been? It would have been 24 frames. So I would have been, what, 13, 11 overnight or something like that. I think that's what it would have been.
I honestly can't remember, but yeah, you were ahead, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, something like that. So then, and then the next session, then it was, going into the last session. I think it may have even been 12, 11. Right. I think we sort of like had to come off a little bit earlier. And but I just remember that spell in the sort of like the third session and fourth session, that every time I kept sort of winning one or two frames, Graham just kept winning another one back, and then, you know, sort of one of us would make 50 odd or 60 to leave the other person needing three snookers on the last red, and then the frame was going for another 20 minutes because that person just wouldn't give that frame up.
Yeah.
It's a final of the world championship. You carry on for, if you need four snookers, you're going to carry on, and you know, anything can happen. That frame could be vital. And so the longer those frames got drawn out, the more tired we both became. And then obviously the last sort of few frames, I potted an unbelievable pink to go I think to go 16 12 up instead of 15 13, and then that was sort of like the killer blow. I think even though he won the next frame, I won the next comfortably, and then I won the last comfortably as well. Yeah.
So what's that feeling like at the end? You know, it's every snooker player's ambition to be world champion, but you're there, your mother's there, the Australian flag, you stood there with the trophy.
You
can't get any better than that. But did it sink in immediately? Or?
No, because I mean, that was just like the best sort of way I could imagine kind of winning it. Maybe apart from having like, you know, my dad and my brother there as well. But to be there with the Australian flag and, you know, all that sort of stuff, it was great pictures for the media back home as well. And it never sunk in because obviously, you know, you're kind of doing all the interviews and stuff straight away. And but then Mike Ganley said, "Oh, just wait a minute, buddy. I'll just like introduce you like to the party." And that's the first time I had like sort of 10 seconds to myself. I was like, and then that was when it was like, oh my god, I want it. Then obviously, you know, had a really good time at the party. Spoke to my dad for like hours on the phone, media back home, and it was a wonderful time.
How important was it then to press on and win the other big tournaments? Because you've since obviously won the UK, the Masters. Was it important to, like I say, press on and sort of join the players who've done that?
Yeah, I mean, it was quite funny because even back then, you know, the game was in a really tough spell because that season when I won the World Championship, I also won the Grand Prix. So I won, and we only had six ranking events. So I won two out of the six ranking events. And you didn't know where the game was going. You know, there was obviously that big, the vote with Barry Hearn and John Davison. You know, like, where is the future of the sport going? Because it wasn't looking great. But Barry came in and changed things up a lot. And it's just incredible sort of the way it's gone, because, you know, I was thinking when I won the World Championship, I think was that my fourth or fifth ranking title that I'd won? It was my fifth ranking title that I'd won. Sort of, so I'd set a goal to win sort of, eight or nine or something, because I just didn't know how many more tournaments we were going to be playing or seasons. You know, nobody knew.
Yeah.
A lot of uncertainty at the game back then. And especially if you're playing six events a season, it's pretty hard to, So, yeah, for the tour to expand the way it has, and then, you know, it's made it much better for the top players as well. And it's given me a much, much better chance to win these great events. And then, you know, obviously winning the World Championship, the next target was to win one of the UK or the Masters. And then once I won the Masters, it was then to really try and win the UK to win the Triple Crown. So,
But you couldn't have done much more. You've been world number one, world champion, UK, Masters, all the rest. But has that been reflected in the coverage you get back in Australia? I mean, are you a big deal there, or is it still snooker still minority sport?
No, I've given up. With back home, I get like, I would never be jealous of another player. That's not really my thing at all. I think anyone kind of deserves the success if they've had to earn it. But it's sort of, I wouldn't say it's hard to take, because the impact that Ding has had on snooker has been wonderful and given us all so many playing opportunities. Yeah. You know, there's like five or six events in China every season now. So, you know, but I kind of look at that, the way China have, embraced Ding and that. And then, you know, I go home and, it's just like, it's just nothing. I mean, after I won the World Championship, I got a lot of recognition. Like, I went back home, I did a lot of TV stuff, all this. But the problem is, if you're a top if you're a top sportsman in Australia, and if you're in another country, it's going to be really hard work for you to get the exposure and to build your profile, because you know you're out of the limelight for so long. And obviously the time difference when we're playing these matches, and you know, and they're not really showing the matches live. Apart from the World Final, they've never shown a match live in Australia before. So that makes it really difficult, but I've kind of accepted that now. It is what it is. You know, snooker's not big in Australia. It's popular for people to play casually, but it's not a big sport in Australia. So I've accepted that, and you know that's just the way it is. You know, it would be nice to get the same endorsements that Ding gets in China.
I'm sure it would.
But you know, that's just the way it is. I've had a great career so far, and I've got a long way to go as well.
Well, one thing that they should certainly be talking about in the papers there was the season 3 years ago when you made the 103 centuries in the end in one season, which was just unprecedented. Of course, you went to the Crucible though in the 90s, didn't you? And there was kind of a lot of talk about it. Did that sort of put you off a little bit?
Yeah, that was. It actually had a really bad effect on, I think, three or four events leading into the World Championships. I went out pretty early because my goal was to try and get them out of the way by the time the Crucible came along, so it wouldn't be a distraction. Yeah. And I never did anything stupid in the matches. Like, I never went for anything really risky where I was risking a frame to make a 100. But it was on my mind to make every 70 or frame winning potential opportunity a century. You know, just get them out of the way. You know, because it seemed throughout the whole season I was just scoring so heavy, you know, making a lot of big breaks. I was playing in a lot of the events as well, which I don't really sort of do now. Yeah, and then I think I was leading into the World Championships. I was on, what was I on? Was I on 91? 92?
In the 90s, certainly, yeah.
How many did I make?
Because people kept mentioning Don Bradman, didn't they? They kept bringing up Don Bradman.
Yeah, I think I made 10 in the tournament. So I finished with... Did I finish 103?
Yeah.
Two against Selby, one against Judge. So I was...
It seemed to me, though, in the end...
93, yes. Yeah. So I was on 93. Yeah, yeah.
It seemed to me, in the end, what happened was, because you were behind against Judd Trump, you forgot about it. And that actually allowed you to then play with the freedom to make them.
Yeah, because the first match I played... Robbie Williams, and I had four.
Yeah.
And I played like unbelievable. It was just like, you know, I think I finished off with back-to-back centuries as well. So, and then I'm thinking 97, and I've got a best out of 25 against Mark Allen, you know, very, very attacking player, and, you know, plays the game in the right way. So I thought, well, I've got a great chance. If I play really well against Mark Allen, I've got a great chance. And so I had two in the match going into the final session. And, and I was playing, you know, unbelievable. And... I missed not an easy black, but one I definitely should have potted. I rattled it to make the 100th century, and then the next frame I've missed a red down the cushion on 90 odd. So it left me on 99, but I think, well, I've got a best out of 25 against Judd, very attacking player. There's no way I can't make a century in this match. But you know, he started off very well, and I was very, very cautious around the table. I was just like, every time I potted a red, I was like, okay, just make the century now and then focus on the rest of the match. And the further that match went away from me, I was 6-2 down. I was thinking, oh my God, don't tell me I can be stuck on 99 centuries like for the season. Like that would just like it would absolutely kill me.
But the thing is, that would still be a great achievement. But it's not the same as getting 100.
No, that's right. I think I was even telling myself like, just even if you make a century and lose, you'll still be like happy. You know, I was just like I was just thinking, just the desperation became that when I, you know, the fact that, you know, I could be the first one to make 100 centuries. You know, not the second or third guy who's made 100, like the very first guy, who sort of broke through that barrier. And then to be left on 99, it just would have been absolutely devastating. And then I was 6-2 down. He started to sort of maybe second-guess himself a little bit. He didn't really sort of put his foot down, allowed me to get back into the match. And then the second session I won 5-3, so I was only 9-7 down. I still didn't look like making a century, but at least I was back in the match. And then from 9-7 down, I played just incredible, sort of high class. I mean, I don't really like the word match play, because I think that when someone gets called a match player, it's sort of like a little bit of a backhanded compliment where they're not like a really good scorer. I think that it's sort of a little bit harsh on Mark Selby sometimes, but you know, he's such a wonderful player. But I did play what I guess you could call like really traditional match play snooker, where The safety was immaculate. You know, scoring sort of like, you know, sort of 50, around 50 sort of breaks most frames, and just didn't really give him a shot. And I think when it was 11 all, was when I finally got a good chance amongst the balls. And obviously I was aware. I mean, every time I was coming to the table in that tournament, I was counting the reds. Is there 10 reds on the table? Yep, we make 100. But that time I wasn't thinking about it. It was
because
the match
was more important. Then.
Yeah, I just wasn't thinking about the century. And then obviously I'm potting the balls and that. I've got to 50 odd. Now I'm aware there's a century on, but the frame is easy. You know, it's just sort of rolling a couple of reds, a couple of blacks, no problem. And then I could finally concentrate on the century, which was the first time I was able to concentrate on making a century break since playing Mark Allen. And then I went on to do it. I've never been more relieved. Even now, I've never been more relieved. Any match that I've won sort of in a decider, or I've come back from nowhere to win, I've never been more relieved than that when I knocked in the green to make the century. And I just smashed around 100 mile an hour, just in absolute relief to go 12-11 in front. And then the crowd went absolutely nuts, and still to this day I've never experienced a crowd sort of cheer louder than that in my life. So and then 12-11 up, now I'm thinking, oh, even if I lose, it doesn't matter, I don't care, I've done it, I've made the 100 centuries. And then I went the next frame as well, did quite a good clearance to win 13-11.
Incredible achievement. Let's talk a little bit about off table life. Obviously you have your son, you're a big Chelsea fan as well, but you're also into this quite a mysterious world for a lot of people, video gaming. I'm not quite sure what exactly it is because I don't follow it myself, but I read a lot of your Twitter. You talk about all that. What is all that?
Yeah, no, I just love I love playing video games. Yeah. I play them to a pretty good level, actually. A really good friend of mine, he plays World of Warcraft. He's like a raid leader, so he's...
Well, already, what is that?
That's basically it's somebody who is responsible for how 25 people perform.
Okay.
So you all go in together, there's 25 of you, you go in together and you've got to defeat like the boss to progress through. It's like Dungeons and Dragons or something like that, but a much more advanced version. And it's a very hard game to play because what I like about it is that, you know, you get personal satisfaction with playing the game to a great level. And with whatever I do in life, I've always got to try and do it the best I can. Yeah. I can never be average at something. So there's been times where I've been really obsessed with that game or other video games like FIFA, for example, which I don't play because I got probably obsessed with that and was playing until like sort of 5 a.m. Birds are tweeting outside. I'm like, oh my God, I've got to play Joe Perry at like 10 in the morning. Practice, I'm going to get like 3.5 hours sleep. Or I've got to get up with Alexander, take him to school, like 2.5 hours sleep and go to the club. So I've gone through many spells like that where it's definitely, I think it's really cost me preparation for certain events. But then it's also really helped me when I've travelled overseas by taking my gaming laptop with me, and it's a great way of killing time where some other players sort of go a bit mad.
Because some players, you see them and they tend to spend all their time together, like they'll sit around and eventually you kind of run out of things to say, whereas you're very definite, you know what you'd like to do, and you appreciate private time as well. Steve Davis and Stephen Hendry were like that. They wouldn't necessarily be with the players all the time. They followed the sort of things they wanted to do.
Yeah, I've noticed that. I mean, it was really hurting Joe Perry's career. I almost felt like pulling him aside. I said, like, you can't just keep doing this. You know, you're mingling with all these people you're trying to compete against.
Yeah.
And I just felt he was, like, almost there where he wasn't treating it like he was actually at a tournament. It's just like a way of getting... He was just getting away and he was just sort of mucking around with you know, Barry Hawkins and co. So he sort of changed that a lot now, actually. He seems a lot more focused at tournaments and you know, he's become sort of top 10 player in the world because of that. I like talking to other players. Like, I've got no problem sort of mingling with other players and stuff like that, but it's, you know, I'd rather sort of be relaxing, getting my mind focused for the next matches and things like that. You know, I don't really like to sort of spend loads of time sort of talking about snooker when I'm not playing matches and you know, stuff like that. I like to, that's why I love playing my video games. I like to like zone out, sort of forget about snooker. Collect our Warhammer figurines, which is like another, like a tabletop strategy game where you actually build the models, you put them together and you actually paint them.
Right.
So I really enjoy doing that too. So I've got a couple of really good things that I can do at tournaments. And you know, like the World Open earlier this year in China, you know, the internet wasn't very good. I didn't actually bring my gaming laptop. I took my Warhammer figurines and I took all my paints and brushes and that. And I was painting in between matches. I was painting in my room, having a really good time, and just, you know, doing that because, you know, I don't know. I guess I'm quite multi-talented, where, you know, I paint them to like a really good level. They've even put some of my miniatures in the cabinets in the shop in Cambridge. So,
okay, yeah. It does seem though, like you said, you have to be the best at everything. You seem like a little bit of an obsessive in a way. Even the way you've talked about your career, you seem to remember almost every shot you've played. You know, this recall from you're a bit of a thinker.
Yeah, I could probably go through every single match I've played as a professional. Whatever I do it to the best of my ability. Mm. I think I've heard Ronnie Sullivan talk the same. When he's done his running, he does it as if he's training to be in the Olympics. When I do something, whether it be video games, whether it be my Warhammer figurines, whether it be kicking the football around with Alexander, you know, I've got to try and be as good as I can be at it. It's just something that I've always done. So I guess I've definitely been obsessed with video games, where it's got to the point where it has had a negative impact on my sort of snooker. You know, there's been many times where I've, you know, I should be going to practice, but I'm staying to play FIFA to win a Division One title or something like that, so I can brag to everyone. Right, yeah. You know, so there's definitely been sort of moments in my career where I've done that. I would never say I haven't been dedicated to snooker. It's probably certainly hasn't been to the level of someone like Mark Selby, because he doesn't really have those sort of other sort of passions. It's not that I don't love snooker, it's just that, like, I get hooked on so many other things that are really sort of fun to do. Like, I find these things so much fun, and it kind of drives Joe mad when he hears me talking about it in the club. He's like, you know, you're 34, like, you shouldn't be doing this. He goes, if my little girls are doing this sort of stuff, I can understand it, or your son. And he goes, well, this is just ridiculous. But on the other hand, Alexander loves it. You know, I can... Yeah. Do all these things with him as well. Like he paints like the figures with me, and it's just a really good thing to do. So, I do have a goal throughout the rest of my career is to do a certain amount of practice each day before I allow myself to play video games and that, which I don't do anymore. I don't get up in the morning and think, oh yeah, maybe I'll just like play for an hour and then I'll go to the club. I don't do that anymore. I get up, you know, take Alexander to school, and then I'll go to the club and do my practice. And then I'm free to do what I want afterwards.
You mentioned Joe Perry there. Just recently in China, you played him. And there was a mysterious incident where you seemed to do a bit of a Quinton Hand, to mention one of your old pals. What was the story there?
Well, that was like pretty much what I've been talking about. Is that because I've been like playing World of Warcraft again, I've been sort of like raiding with my friend and that, and really enjoying playing the game, you know, like, you know, Alexander goes to bed and then, you know, Miller's doing, she's doing a master's at Cambridge University, doing criminology. So she's studying. When Alexander's gone to bed, she's like studying really hard. So I've got a bit of time to play my games. I'm like, yeah, great, you know. And so I took my gaming laptop with me. It's a big Alienware laptop. It has its own carry-on case. It's that big. Like, the monitor's huge. Like, you've seen it in the championship league.
Yeah, it's a big thing.
And so I took it with me. I didn't bring my Warhammer figurines because I thought that I trusted that the internet was going to be good where we were going. So I didn't bring my Warhammer figurines or my paintbrushes or anything. So I took a bit of a gamble that the internet would be good. And when we got to Daoqing, the hotel was great. Everything like that, the playing conditions were great, but there was absolutely nothing to do. And I mean nothing to do. There was a Starbucks which was outside the hotel, and that was it. There was like 100 channels, 99 of them were Chinese spoken language, the other one was CNN. The internet was like pretty much like from the Stone Age. You know, if you go into like something like you know, you check the football results on BBC, you got to like, you click the web page and it loads after about 2 minutes.
Right, yeah.
It was insane. Like you couldn't watch YouTube videos or anything. And what I really love doing is when I'm like playing my games or if I'm like painting, I love listening to stuff on YouTube or watching people play games or painting guides, other sort of stuff going on in the background. So all I had was CNN going 24/7. And I couldn't play my games, I couldn't go on the internet, I couldn't do anything. I was just kind of like, you know, what am I doing? And I noticed that other players were mingling and I was thinking, well, you know, but then, yeah, you're getting sort of like nudged in the ribs every 2 minutes to sign this or for autographs and stuff like that. And, you know, it's kind of, I have no problem whatsoever in signing things, but you know, when it's in a player's sort of downtime, when he's trying to sort of relax in between matches, it can get a little bit much sometimes in China. And so yeah, I went kind of mad over there. I was really jet lagged. I was just sleeping until sort of 3 p.m. every day. And I was, you know, getting up, playing my match, then going to bed, and then, you know, sleeping like 14 hours a day and not really doing anything, not really eating properly, and just, because every time I was waking up and thinking, well, what am I going to do? I'm just going to stare at the four walls for like, you know, 6 hours. And it really affected me psychologically. It was very interesting because, you know, never at all do I ever get sort of annoyed in matches or anything like that. And so I was due to play Joe Perry, and I was very much up for the match. I thought, you know, right, come on, you know, like get focused. And the first two matches I played in the international was on the match table, or one, well, on table two, which is the table next to the match table, and they're on their own with the crowd. The back tables are in a separate part altogether to the venue. And so when Joe Perry and I walked out, Joe played his previous two matches on there, so he kind of knew what to expect. I'd never seen anything like it before. We walk out, there was a table, which was Joe and I's, and then there was five tables, which were completely empty, which they used earlier in the week when there was a lot of matches to be played. So in between the five, after the five tables, there was Judd Trunk's table when he was playing James Watana. And instantly I thought, why on earth are they not playing my match and Joe's match and Judd's match next to each other? Why not just have the two tables together? At least there might be some sort of atmosphere. So I've walked out, myself, Joe Perry, the referee, and the person doing the scoring. And there was three people in the crowd. Three people. So could you imagine walking out to play a last 16 match of the International Championship? Could you imagine somebody walking out to play in the Crucible with three people in the crowd? And I looked at Judd's end, and he had about five or six people, and three of them were James Watana's mates that flew over from Thailand. And I let it bother me, and you know, I thought, like, why are they doing this? Because I think it's a disgrace in China where they charge so much for the ticket prices that they just, you know, they make it unaffordable for the people that really want to watch the games, and it makes no atmosphere whatsoever. I can understand it when in the qualifiers, you know, in Preston or something like that, perhaps, where we play these qualifying venues, you're prepared for that. I wasn't prepared to play in front of three people, you know, basically that there was more people involved on the actual table than there were actually watching. And there was this guy, out of the three people there was a guy who was in the front sort of row bit, sort of close to our table, and I was playing my shots, and I noticed he was not on one mobile phone, but he was on two mobile phones. He was texting and stuff with a smile on his face, and yeah, it was all sort of I don't know, it just seemed like a bit of a joke to him, and I kept sort of, it's like clicking my fingers to get his attention. The referee was kind of telling him, but he kept getting the phone out, and I just sort of got very, very frustrated. You know, Joe won a couple of close frames, and I was just like, you know, well, yeah, I don't know. I've never really experienced anything like that before.
But there's a moment before you smash the pack where you must think, you either decide to do it or not.
Yeah, because...
So why did you?
Yeah, I was 3-1 down at the interval, and then it was like 4-1, 5-1. And I just... Then at this stage, there's nobody watching whatsoever. And I was just thinking, like, I don't know. I really don't know what I was thinking. I wasn't thinking to give Joe an easy chance so he could just finish off the match and so I could move on to Guangzhou.
It's almost like a cry for help. Almost.
Yeah, I was just like, I don't know. I just, I mean, I did it, and it was almost like in slow motion in my head, and I was about to hit the wire. I was thinking, just stop, don't do it. And the balls just went absolutely everywhere. And the funny thing was, I actually got safe, and Joe missed a really easy red, because I think he was a bit unnerved by it. He certainly would have been very surprised by it, because I've never even done anything like that in practice. And I've ended up winning the frame, and the problem is I'm 5-2 down, but there's probably a chance I could get back into the match. I'm thinking, well, oh, like, what do I do? Like, if I win this match, Joe will never talk to me ever again, probably. So I didn't know what to do, but luckily he knocked in, like, a great red, and he made 100, so that was, you know, I didn't have to worry about that, but... Yeah, I was just incredibly frustrated, you know, and yeah, I don't know. It was just, I think, 3 or 4 days in a row of pretty much not saying a word to anybody other than the referee, if he could clean the white or something like that in my previous two matches. just really took its toll. It was kind of like being in solitary confinement, I guess. I was really regretting not bringing my Warhammer figurines or loading up the iPad with loads of stuff. Sure. Because the thing is, once you're out with the iPad, you think, oh, yeah, I'll just download shows. We couldn't download any shows because the internet was so bad.
Yeah, but I think it's interesting because I think a lot of snooker fans don't realise this. You know, it's people say it's only a game, but it's not. It's a profession. And it's what you'll be remembered for.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
In general, though, do you enjoy the life of a professional?
Yeah, I do, very much so. I mean, it is tough. The China trips are very tough. Mm. They are, because especially for the guys who've got families. You know, Alexander, he cries every single time I go away now. And he doesn't let go either. I can sort of like, I give him a big hug and then I let go and he's still clinging on, you know, like for dear life.
Yeah.
And it's very, very tough for him. So, you know, but I think I handle it really well. I mean, I've had really good success in China. I've won 3 ranking events there and you know, I performed really well at the World Open. I played fantastic. I looked like, you know, I was really confident of winning the first 2 ranking events of the season. And I mean, Joe played, well, what I thought nobody will be able to play like that again throughout the rest of the season against me. And then I got to the semis of Romania and Ronnie played even better. So, but the funny thing is that people sort of look at my season and go, oh, he's not really had a great season. But, you know, 7 events, 2 semis and a win. And I think two players have won more matches than me in the season so far. So it's not been a bad season. It's just that China trip, it obviously didn't go very well because, obviously, you know, I lost to Michael Holt 6-5 in the last 16 of the China Championship. So unfortunately, those 2 events have kind of put a little bit of a dent into, you know, what's been a sort of like a promising start to the season. Otherwise, the only regret I've had this season was entering the Shanghai Masters. Nothing to do with Shanghai or you know, the Shanghai Masters, but I was in Australia for 3 weeks in August. I didn't play in the Paul Hunter Classic, and I got back and I entered the Shanghai Masters, and I wasn't prepared for it. I got back from Australia. I didn't really have the break in Australia I wanted. I was there, and what I've done in previous years when I've gone to Australia, I've come back to the UK thinking, oh, I wish I saw him a bit more, or maybe I wish I saw this person.
Yeah.
This trip, I didn't come back feeling that. I'd seen everybody. Every day I was seeing someone. I was like, you know, playing golf with mates or doing whatever. I saw absolutely everybody. And it didn't feel like a break at all. So I got back to the UK and last thing I wanted was to practice to get ready for Shanghai. And I didn't really practice that much at all leading into that tournament. I got to Shanghai. I just didn't want to play. I wasn't sharp at all. And it just seemed to have, like, even though I got to the semis of Romania, I never really got to prepare for a tournament that well, even up until now, getting beat by Stuart there. You know, I still haven't been able to prepare, so it's never good to lose, but it's come at a good time so I can prepare for the UK, because I've only had, obviously, I got back from China Saturday night, so I've only had a couple of days to prepare. I thought I played really well today, actually. Like, I only made one mistake, and Stuart just played unbelievably well. So the defeat against Stuart today, I got absolutely no problems with whatsoever. I'm fully at ease with that. But the other defeats in China was very frustrating, because when you're playing so many tournaments, if you're getting beat in the sort of like the middle rounds, the last 16s, last 32s, you're not really taking any momentum to the next tournament, where you've only got a few days to get ready for that. But if you're doing really well, if you're making quarters and semis, then that sort of just carries through, that flows through nicely from tournament to tournament. And I've been stuck in that middle part where I haven't really been able to get anything going. So now I've got a good, really good sort of, you know, well, good like 8-9 days to get ready for the world, for the UK Championship. So, you know, I'm really looking forward to that.
Okay, and just to wrap up, let's just talk about the future. I mean, you're a young man still in your 30s. You keep yourself fit, and from what we've seen in the game, players in their 40s are doing really well. So, there's no reason why you can't carry on another 15, maybe 20 years.
Yeah, I think it's all down to your mindset, really. I think that when you hear about players like, you know, Willie Thorne's mentioned, oh, your eyes go, you don't see the balls as well from distance. I think that's a load of garbage, because that's true when you get, maybe when you're 50 or you're 60 or something, obviously your eyesight deteriorates. But you look at the players who have really sort of lost their way. They were drinkers, they were smokers, they were gamblers, very stressful lives. Didn't look after themselves in any way whatsoever. I mean, you look at all the top players now, you know, pretty much all the tournament winners are, you know, slim, you know, fit looking guys. So the game has just completely changed. You know, you look at you know, John Higgins, he's 41 and he's finished off the match with 3 centuries in a row to win the China Championship. So obviously he's not as brilliantly as good as he was in that regard with his consistency, because he doesn't work as hard as he used to. You know, he sort of said that, and you can't criticise for somebody who's achieved everything he's achieved in the game to still practice 4, 5, you know, 6 hours a day. It's just not going to happen. So I feel as if you're still putting the work in, then you'll maintain a really good standard of play. Obviously, confidence comes and goes, but I think generally when players have sort of, you know, fallen off the tour, or it's because of their dedication to the game was completely different to what it was maybe 5 or 6 years previously. You know, all the players, like, you know, that have slipped down the rankings have all just basically stopped practicing and started doing an hour a day instead of 4 hours a day.
Okay, well, you made a good decision to walk away from that doll queue all those years ago and carry on, because it's not turned out too badly. And as you say, it is difficult for the non-British players, but of all the non-British players, you've been the most successful. So that is something to be proud of, I think.
Yeah, definitely. And you know, I think that I think myself and Ding can be really proud with what we've done in the game, because we've broken that mould of the British dominance where, you know, overseas players couldn't really be successful. We've had, like, you know, James Watana and Tony Drago have success, but obviously, you know, not on the same level that Ding and I have won. You know, I think we've won, you know, both won the Masters, and I'm sure one day he'll definitely win the World Championship. But, you know, combined, we've probably won about sort of like, you know, 26, 27 major big titles, you know, ranking titles and, you know, Masters Invitational events. So, you know, it's I'm very proud to sort of be in that in the same era with him.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time to chat, Neil, and we look forward to much more success in the future. Thank you.
Yeah. All right. Cheers, Dave. Thanks.
Cheers. Thank you.